Welcome to Measured Impact, where we talk to brands who prove that doing good and doing well aren't mutually exclusive. But today we're taking a little break from the format and I'll be the interviewee. On this show, we spend a ton of time talking to folks about why they do the work that they do, why they work for the companies that they work for, and what it's like to work on something that's bigger than just the brand. Well, we feel the same way. So I wanted to give our listeners a little bit of context for the work that we do, how we got here, how I got here, and why we're so focused on proving impact for the companies that we partner with and the guests that we have on this podcast. But that's also why we tapped my buddy, Ron Young Jr., to help us tell that story. Ron's a creator. He's an award-winning podcast host. He's one of my favorites. His podcast, Wait For It, is a winner of 3 Podcast Academy Awards and was listed as one of the best podcasts by the New York Times, Vogue, and Vulture. He's the CEO of Big Ron Studios, and he's a regular voice and one of my favorites on NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour. So today, Ron's going to turn the mic on me, and we'll talk a little bit about my backstory as a way to cap off season 1. Let's dive in.
Why don't we start with the question that you often start with when you're doing these interviews, which is, who are you, where do you live, and who do you work for?
My name is Neil Callanan. I live in Rochester, New York, which is upstate, and I work for Loose Grip, and I host the Measured Impact podcast.
Nice. What does it feel like to be on the other side of the mic?
It's a little less stressful because I feel like you had to do the work and I didn't have to, like, you know, I don't have to keep it going. If it's bad, it's your fault, right? It's
not mine. Sure.
little less weighty. No pun intended. You know what I'm saying? Yeah.
I get it. I love how you started off by blaming me for if this goes awry. It's like a signal to the listener, like, just in case.
You'll hear from the Loose Grip team that I'm very good at contextualizing, pre-blaming others for anything that goes wrong. And if it's successful, obviously, I was great.
That's just good PR, man.
Honestly, no, it's good. I like to be able to, you know, the work we do, I like to talk about. And I'm super psyched to get somebody like you to ask questions about it because I love the work you guys do.
Super psyched to be here and glad you thought of me. Speaking of Loose Grip, what is it that y'all do? Like, give a listener who comes in on this one, this is their first episode, they haven't listened to the other 7 or 8. What is it that y'all do?
So Loose Grip is, we're like 17 or 18 years. I can't bat at math. Digital agency, which is pretty generic in the description. I would say specifically what we do is help brands and organizations kind of make the most of their digital presence. And that might be in the form of content, that might be in the form of advertising, that might be in the form of their web presence. And sometimes that's us creating things for them, like a traditional digital marketing agency where we're, you know, making ads or generating creative or videos or whatever. And then in other cases, more recently, we've done a lot more where we're focused in on the insight side. So where we utilize our data team to kind of take a look at everything they're doing and help brands figure out what's working about everything they're doing and what's not and how to do more of the good stuff and less of the bad stuff.
Is this your dream job? Is this exact tasks and everything that you're doing with Loose Grip, is this what you've always wanted to do? How did you evolve to do the work that you do?
Yeah, when I was like 5, I was like, I want to be a data analyst, man. I hope I get to work for some CPG brands and some B2B, whoever's. Yeah, I mean, honestly, I have been into marketing forever. I remember taking a class in high school. I was kind of one of those kids where, like, if you kept me engaged, I was, like, pretty excited and a good student. And if you didn't, I was a real pain in your ass. And I had a teacher who kind of after the first class was super thoughtful about keeping me engaged in like a follow-on self-led thing. And she got me an internship at a local nonprofit where I was able to do sort of like just graphic design and help with brochures for Special Olympics and stuff. Like just do some work that was like out in the world. And so anyway, I liked marketing, advertising, and kind of liked the idea of creativity. But I always sort of had a little bit more of a capitalist marketer vibe than a artist vibe to me. Mm-hmm. And then so I went to college. I majored in advertising and marketing and, you know, worked at the university paper running the advertising department and kind of been doing this for a long time now. I would say I wouldn't have imagined doing it for myself and I wouldn't imagine doing it for myself for this long. That was sort of a little bit more happenstance, or at least it was 20 years ago.
So I feel like when you talk about going from doing the nonprofit to being more capitalistic in your intent, I guess there's an ability of you to say that I really want to be engaged in the work that I'm doing. Did you feel disengaged doing nonprofit work and there was something more exciting about things that maybe that were for profit? Or what was the difference in your mind between doing those two different kind of work streams?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I have... You know, my parents were always involved in a lot of like, you know, charity type stuff. It's kind of a lot of the people in my life were involved in it. I have been anxious to be involved and help the world in, you know, little ways and big ways, and Big Brothers Big Sisters and mentoring and all that kind of stuff, even from like first day out of college kind of thing. But if you've done any work in the nonprofit space, you know that it doesn't really work the way that you think it does. And in a lot of ways, I just have found my experience, even having chaired the board of a very successful nonprofit, there's so much energy put into raising money and it colors everything that nonprofits do. And so while I think the impact is really amazing for a lot of the work that these nonprofits are doing and the people who work in them have these like, you know, earnest willingness to kind of like stick through the bureaucracy. The bureaucracy is real and there is so much energy put into, can we raise money? Where are we getting grants? And I always felt like you're kind of begging for money a little bit in that side of things. And I just said, never felt super comfortable to me. Whereas on the capital side or just on the for-profit business side, I've always thought that there's an opportunity to do good if you were genuine about it. And if you make more money, you can do more good. And I've sort of always believed that and have more recently sort of seen how that has implications in the world and how other brands are getting to do that kind of stuff. So kind of a long way of saying like working in nonprofits is really hard. And I have so much respect for the people who do. And I'm just not good at the slow pace of fundraising and board meetings. And it just wasn't well suited for my anxious, quick to be moving kind of personality.
In terms of kind of how you've positioned Loose Grip now, you do a lot of marketing support and kind of digital forward work for organizations that are trying to, as you said, do more good as they make more money. And they're trying to make sure that they're demonstrating these progressive values as they move forward, or whatever theme that they are attached to, or whatever agenda that they're trying to push forward. In most cases, it being progressive. You are trying to make sure that they tie those two things together, because one of the things you said is that profits and purpose aren't mutually exclusive. Can you talk to me about that pivot towards that work specifically and how you got into that?
Well, you know, we lucked out in that we had a couple clients who happened to sort of be in that space. And they didn't necessarily come to us to say, hey, tell us how big our impact is, or help us measure our impact, or tell us how much good we're doing in the world. But once we started working with these guys, it was clear like it was a big part of what they were trying to figure out. And so we sort of honed our process and our intent accidentally by just trying to solve problems. And Loose Grip's always been a company who's really good at like, hey, if you need something, like, dude, you want some like blimp strategy tomorrow for some skywriting or whatever? Like, we'll say yes and we'll figure it out. Like, we're good at you know, being resourceful. And we just had a couple clients who started to go down this route of sort of saying like, okay, yeah, well, we're selling some stuff and that's really cool, but like, what's the impact of the stuff we're doing over here? And so we were lucky to work with some really, really awesome companies who kind of gave us the challenge in a way that was like freeing enough to come and say like, hey, wouldn't it be cool if we knew this, right? And like over the years, that work has just become more appealing to us for a number of reasons. And I think it makes our team more jazzed, right? It's not to say like the other work we do is not hard, but it's not as unique. And I would say helping brands identify the impact of their advocacy or their values or their activism is pretty unique. And that kind of feels cool to be doing work that you don't see a lot of other people doing the same thing as, right? Whereas if like you looked up LinkedIn ads agency or whatever, like you probably will literally find 1,000 of them. And I think our team is really good and I think we will do a great job for you. But I think there's probably 100 other agencies who are also really good and will probably do a great job too, you know? Whereas in this specific space, I think we're pretty unique and that's exciting to us.
Let me ask you personally, Neil, like you, when you wake up in the morning and you're about to do your job, what excites you the most about what you're doing at Loose Grip. And I mean you personally, not the company. When Neil gets out of bed, you're like, oh, I get to do this. What is that for you when you're doing this job?
Man, honestly, we get to work with really smart people. And I would say for me, somewhere along the line, there was a little bit of a switch, right? And that switch is like in the early days, you're working with smart people who just need a solution to a very specific problem, like make us a website or whatever, right? And so we would do that and we would take literally any work you would provide because we just needed to pay the bills. And the joy of the work was in just like the self-sufficiency of it, honestly. And, you know, I say that I feel like there's like a little bit of a entrepreneurial journey where you're like pretty token, right? First year, it's like, oh man, just I will literally do any work you want. If it will pay the bills, right? I'm so happy to just have a source of income. And then the second year, you start to make a little bit of money. And that's really cool because you've probably making more money than you ever made in a job. And that feels pretty great. And for me, I was still working mostly by myself. And somewhere on the third or the fourth year, like you make a bunch of money, but you're like, this is pretty isolating, right? And it's not that fun to just be like a standalone consultant guy who just gets pulled into stuff and is kind of half on a bunch of teams, but not really on any teams. So then, you know, bringing people to the table on our team who are awesome is like the lesson I have to keep learning, right? Which is basically what jazzes me. It's working with really smart people. And that comes in two forms, right? It's the clients we work with and the team that we work with. And, you know, there is this mindset in when you first start a business where you're like, you can't envision paying anybody the amount of money they deserve. And you can't like envision like caring for, you know, people's livelihoods. And what you realize over time is like, man, when you invest in the right people, your work is more exciting. It's literally more enjoyable. In the beginning, you're just sort of trying to find people who will do kind of as good of a job as you can think of to tell them to do. And then, you know, somewhere along the lines, you just go, oh man, like, no, I want people who are so much better than me that I would never think to do any of these things that they want to do, right? Like literally, for example, start a podcast. I can tell you, I wanted no part of this. Absolutely no part of this, right? And I got kind of bullied into it by our team. And man, it's been great. I like talking to cool companies. Like I posted something the other day about how I was on a backpacking trip with my buddies. I do an annual backpacking trip with some of my oldest friends in the world. And we kind of like go way into the backcountry. And like, I'm literally in the middle of the woods and I look down and I'm like, man, there's a literal Peak Design case, a Hydropack thing, and a bar or a bottle of Dr. Bronner's. Like, I literally interviewed these companies in the last 5 weeks. And like, that's just cool, man. I would never have thought of that, like getting to work with the companies whose stuff I actually really like and whose companies I think are doing really cool shit, you know?
I feel like one of the things we talked about, especially in our conversations leading up to this, is that there was one shift from the standard marketing you were doing to working more with companies that had a purpose. But then you had an even deeper shift down that path when you suffered some personal tragedy that kind of like set you down a path that felt even more specific in that you really needed to be engaged in projects that kept you engaged that you could actually care about. Talk me through that a little bit.
Yeah, well, so in October of 2024, we lost our son, Shay. He was 4 and a half and he had epilepsy and he passed away from something called SUDEP, which is a long, you know, complicated acronym for basically saying like an epilepsy patient who passes away and they're not really sure why. And as you can imagine or you can't imagine unless you've been through it, like your brain just stops really working for a while. So I don't really remember doing any work for 90 days. Like, I don't really remember any of it. Honestly, it was such a blur that first few months afterwards. And there was a couple meetings where I was like, okay, I'll go to this meeting. This is be like, you know, I look at it a month out on the calendar and be like, okay, I can get my shit together by then and like go. And like a day or two before, I would just like have this like crisis of confidence where I was like, not about whether or not I could do the thing, but more like, man, I can't pretend to care at all. I literally could not pretend to care about people's things. And apathy is super contagious. And in client work, like, you know, if leadership is apathetic and they're not jazzed, then your team's not jazzed and your client's not jazzed, and then nobody wants to do any of the stuff, right? Mm-hmm. And so I, you know, had all this time to have introspection and reflection and like honestly just a lot of time like sitting around in my house being sad, right? Like not having anything else to do. Like I didn't do much but like exercise and walk my dog. And through that, I took some time to inventory like, okay, what is this going to look like? What am I doing? What's the purpose of all this? And my insight was basically like, there's work that I'm like jazzed to do and I can show up. My team can prepare, help me prepare, and I can show up and I can like genuinely be interested. And when I am generally interested, I, as a human being, I'm much better at my job. And I'm sure everybody's like that. But when you suffer a tragedy and you have the like kind of loss to the scale that my wife and I did, you literally can't, I'm not kidding. I could not pretend. And I'm very good at bullshitting. Like I can go into a like a social environment and like, yeah. I am a guy who can like grip and grin with the best of them and like genuinely engage in conversations with people whose hobbies maybe I don't care about or their work and thing challenges that I don't, you know, really tie to. But the truth of the matter is like a lot of the work that we do from a loose grip standpoint, or especially the work we did, didn't feel as consequential as I needed it to be to jazz me up. And so when I was looking at the work we were doing, it was pretty clear that the work that I could kind of point to and say, oh man, this is like, yeah, it's like marketing and yeah, I'm helping somebody like sell some shit maybe, but it's the kind of companies that I'm proud to work with and that I'm excited by the way that they're approaching it. And I'm excited by the people who I work with. That became very clear that that was the only work I was capable of doing anymore. Like my team would tell you, like I used to be a little bit involved in every client and I started paring that down. And then it just happened that month or two after coming back to work, I looked down and I realized like, oh, the only client work I'm involved in is brands who were looking to help figure out insights and they also care about some level of do-goodery and just felt like the right push for us.
Neil, I'm wondering for you personally, especially, and I've been a person who has suffered tragedy of that magnitude. And I feel like the one thing that I always noted was that waking up in the morning with a purpose and saying, I got to be doing something. It is typically the response to this idea that we're not here long, that things just don't, everything that we want to do, we don't necessarily have to wait for. You know what I mean? Like maybe we should just go ahead and do it. And we spend how much time that we spend wasting doing the things that we don't even want to be doing or we don't even understand that we're doing. I'm wondering, was it only in your instinct to just be like, oh, I just don't want to work on this other project anymore? Was it only like that? Or did it ever congeal down to you in like a words or a single moment?
Yeah, I think I would go back to the example of I was scheduled to go to this meeting and I just was like trying to gin up the, ugh. And you know, I'm a guy who like likes typically before we lost Shay, I loved to travel, right? Like work travel and I'm good and I'm, you know, I'm jazzed by people, I'm extroverted. And I just remember feeling like, oh, this is what it feels like to be introverted. Like I remember the exact moment where I was like, oh shit, I'm already drained just thinking about talking to these people and pretending to care. And also like, you know, as you probably know, when you go through something super heavy, people really don't know how to engage with you. And, yes. You know, I've spent a lot of time writing and talking about grief generally. But what I'll say is we're all pretty bad at it. And especially in the workplace,
yes.
There is nowhere for people to know. Do you want to talk about it? Do you not want to talk about it? Should I address it at all? Should I not address it? You know, and I'll just leave it with the idea that I'm not only a man capable of caring about something that just seemed like nonsense, but I'm a guy who wanted and wants to this day to talk about my son. I need to talk about him. And I've been pretty forward with that. But like doing that with clients is hard, right? Like people, you know, they want you to come in and help them solve their thing. And, you know, I'm not saying I'm going to break down in the middle of a meeting and need everybody to stop and do whatever. But like, I'm also not going to pretend that that's the thing I'm not thinking about all day, every day. And so I just had this moment where I was like, fuck, I don't want to go do this thing at all. And it was the kind of work that I actually typically am jazzed by, you know? So I don't think I was quick to have the insight of, hey, this kind of work is better than this kind of work for me or whatever. But I was quick to go, I'm not going to be able to fake it. And that feels like a disservice to them and to my team, right? If I'm like a big sad sack person. Like, my team can't operate in that. They're better off without me there. And so, you know, finding ways to like think about it in the context that was like actionable for me took a long time, but I think I had the sense pretty early.
I love what you said about us not being able to handle grief well in a business setting. I've also found that to be the case. And I could think of ways that I handled it poorly beforehand. And I could think of ways.
Super embarrassing. Like, I totally have ways where I'm like, oh man, I can't believe
I. That was the wrong thing.
I don't know if you've ever listened to any or read any Rob Delaney stuff. He's a stand-up comedian. He's from Catastrophe. It's like a Amazon show. Like,
yeah.
He lost a son who was like three. And I always point people to that book because one of the things he talks about is this idea of like, your dog dies. Please do not reference that in relation to somebody losing a human person in their thing. And you, not once it happens, you see it in the world all the time. And you're so cringed out. You're like, yeah, we lost our dog last year. I'm like, I fucking love dogs, man. I love them. But like, I think he refers to them as practice deaths. He's like, those are practice deaths. They help you work up the energy for the real ones. But yeah, we're all really bad at it. And that's especially true in business. And I think I was pretty open with my team all along. Part of that was the reason I did a bunch of writing about it, because I needed the people around me to understand what I was going through. But when you're working in client service, you don't get to go in and be like, well, culturally, Fortune 500 company, I think you should really have a different policy about talking about grief. I can't go in and change their thing, you know?
Yeah. Well, I'm wondering, how does that impact how you deal with your own employees and maybe your friends or even acquaintances? Because once you have that veil lifted, it's hard to put it back on. And when you face people, when you're confronted with people who are dealing with grief, it certainly changes your approach when you've confronted it yourself. So I'm wondering, what does it look like now for you to not in work, but I mean, like, if people are dealing with grief, have you noticed a shift in how you deal with them, especially when it comes to your employees?
Yeah, I would say I don't reference my dog dying. That's step one. or their dog dying. Honestly, I think I'm a lot more inquisitive than I would have been before, right? I was super scared. I think as people, we're very awkward with grief. And so we're scared to be inquisitive. And I don't necessarily mean inquisitive in the sense of like, you know, you will have people say like, oh my God, what happened? And they like want a specific thing as if that's going to make the situation better. And it's not. But more so like just, I love when people ask me about my son. And so I try to do that with people if they lose somebody. Hey, oh, tell me about your dad. Tell me about your mom. What was he like when you were little? You know, like kind of those questions. I try to be a little bit more inquisitive in a way that doesn't naturally lend itself to platitudes, right? Like the, well, there just are no words. I'm like, well, there are. They're mostly swear words. And you know, like there are some words.
Plenty of words.
Just acknowledging that it sucks and it's awkward and there's not a right way to do it. Everybody's different. But getting a chance to reminisce about that person is a gift. And the cool thing about your team is like, if they're not the kind of people who can be empathetic and caring and try to support you, then like they don't have to work for you. But the people that we hired were naturally really good at giving me the space I needed and giving me the support that I needed, because we attract really good people, not just like aptitude wise, but attitude wise, right? Like we work hard to make sure that the people who fit our team and the kind of people who can express caring is like not something that we have a checkbox for, but like you certainly can say like, hey, does this person seem genuine, right? And curious. And those are two things that we very much consider when we're interviewing people for a job with us, you know?
I have a couple more questions, but before we move on to them, I want to ask you, what was your favorite thing about your son? If you could tell me a favorite memory.
Yeah, I mean, my son was super mischievous. He was a very mischievous 4.5-year-old, and like you can see the smirks. And I count myself lucky in that we have lots of videos and photos and stuff, right? You can really like lionize people in their passing. Mm-hmm. You're always questioning whether that memories are real or you're remembering a memory and then it's like a version of a thing that didn't really exist. And so whenever I go back and I watch these videos of Shay, like, man, him ripping around on a bike, like the kid loved to be on a bike. I love mountain biking. I love being on a bike. And it was just like a thing he was naturally very good at from like literally age three. He was rolling around on a two-wheeler by himself, never touched a training wheel in his life. And just like he would literally scream with joy while he was doing it. And sometimes I feel like, oh man, I'm really making that up. And then I go back and watch a video and I'm like, no, that was literally, he was literally screaming. It was great. And people always said he was a lot like me in terms of his mischievous bent, but he also was just like a funny kid. And everybody thinks their kid is special and everybody thinks their kid's funny, but he was like legitimately funny. And that's not really that normal for all 4.5 year olds, you know?
I will say that when I first met you, you did give mischievous very well. So
yeah, it's hereditary. my father passed away not too long ago. And the through line in our family is definitely mischief, right? Like if you could see, there's like a smirk my dad had that I have that my son had. I don't know if it's nature or nurture, but it's real.
One of my favorite things about you is that I always feel like there's a joke or something that you're about to say that you don't ever say because you're very professional. You keep it honest. But there's a few times where I've been like, yo, he's about to say something wild, but you've never actually said it. So I've always been like, that's the energy.
Producer Sarah is probably shaking her head somewhere saying like, yeah, no, sometimes he says it and we have to cut it out. So
love it. Well, let me ask you, okay, so how do you make this pivot? Because we just talked about the fact that you see these clients and you're like, you've lost your ability to like, really, and use the word, I lost my ability to give a shit, is what she said.
No, more. I lost my ability to pretend to give a shit.
There we go. I lost my ability to pretend to give a shit. And I'm wondering, how do you make the pivot to being able to do the type of work that you want to do and to work with the companies that you care about without tanking your business? You know what I mean? Because sometimes we have to do the work that pays the bills simply because it has to be done and I got to get this rent paid, but it's not necessarily the thing that I care about the most. But if you get rid of all of those tasks and you're only left with the ones that matter or the ones that you think matter, maybe that's not as profitable for you. So how are you able to do that without tanking the business?
Yeah, well, I would say, you know, in full transparency, LoseScript still does a wide range of work. And the ethos, I think, work both directions. So we work with some B2B tech companies, and their work is a little bit more tactical and strategic, but like, they're not necessarily trying to change the world all the time. And they work in an environment that is definitely more serious, right? Cybersecurity or data centers or whatever, right? But I'm a believer that we can do that work and bring our attitude and our values from a LoseScript standpoint to that side of the business and have a really positive impact for them, right? Like they're not all going to go out and like post tomorrow about Pride Month and the specifics of the Stonewall riots, right? That's not who they all are. But I do think that we can help them identify that some of their charity work that they do is maybe it's more point in time thing, right? They're donating money around the holiday seasons or they're, you know, we have a couple of tech clients where they do like a virtual Santa who, does like a video conferencing call in to a bunch of sick kids in the hospital. And it always goes well for them. And the content's just really great. And it like brings cool vibes. It's like, they're a technology company, right? But I do think there's stories to be told in the uses of the work, right? And so what we learn on the activism side and on the value side is like, man, that storytelling is a big part of who we are. And almost everybody's got good stories to tell. And I don't mean that in like a greenwashing sense or in like a virtue signaling. I mean, like the teams we're working with, we can encourage them to do more good if we help them see the impact of the good that they do, even if that good is a 1% of their 100% of their business, right? We have some where it's literal 100%, right? Because they're a nonprofit and everything they're doing is working towards that cause, but it's a spectrum, right? And even on that 1% spectrum, there's still a lot of opportunities for impact. And I think a lot of these brands, one of the things we can help them do is just see how they actually play together on both sides.
When it's all said and done in the future, many years from now, when you're gone and maybe LoseScript lives on, what do you want your legacy to be? And what do you want the legacy of LoseScript to be?
I believe a lot in intentionality. And so from a personal standpoint, I want my legacy for anything that I do to be about like the power of being intentional with your focus and your energy and your time and your resources and the outputs that that can have. I've been really lucky in a ton of ways, and LoseScript wouldn't be here without all that luck and without all the support systems and the public education and all the things that went into that, right? But I have conversations with people, even some of my closest friends who maybe are like a little bit more in a environment where they're just totally burned out and it's a real corporate job and they don't like their job or they don't have any ownership to change it or that kind of thing. I really always wish for them to just have more intentionality. Like, I think a lot of things in life are just literally deciding to do a thing and not spending so much energy worrying about whether you deserve it or whether you can do it or whether you have the skills to do it and just being intentional about it, right? So, like, I would say if I can help people see that they can decide what they want to do with their time, their energy, their output, and that they can control that, that's like really cool. There's a guy I want to give some credit to, Chris Gillibeau. He wrote a bunch of books, still writes. He wrote a book called The Art of Nonconformity, and it's a quick read. I recommend it a lot. But his take was basically like, write yourself a personal annual review, which I do every year. Take time to like just treat yourself like you would a business. The power of it is amazing, right? And so I think of like the more I can share that out, like deciding how many books you want to read every year and deciding how many days you want to spend traveling and making some audacious goals about your adventures or your fitness or whatever, right? Like, I just had never been around people who showed me that some of those things are just like decisions you make. The decision is the hard part, right? There's so much work that's going to go into it, but most people just don't ever stop to think like, oh, that's possible. And I think there's a lot of opportunity in people just being super intentional. And a lot of the folks we've talked to, they're so intentional, especially like those who are on the leadership teams, they thought to be different. And then, on the Loose Grip side, I'd want everybody to feel the impact of that and to enjoy working with really smart people and see how fun that is. We did an episode with Peter Daring, who's the CEO of Peak Design. And the thing I loved the most, because I was like chuckling to myself about it, is he was talking about how he had to put time in his schedule to fuck around. And he literally, like on his calendar, has like time to fuck around. And he was telling the story about how new guy came and he was a real type A guy. And he's like, guys, we gotta do this and then this and then this. We are not here to fuck around. And Peter said like, no, I had to stop him right there and say like, no, we literally are here to fuck around. Like, that's the purpose of the business. It's like, yes, we all want to have jobs and we all want to do the things. But like, I love that ethos of just like, man, we don't have to take ourselves so seriously. Those are decisions you make, right? And they're contagious. And I think from a Loose Grip standpoint, like, we want to be serious people who do good stuff and crush work for our clients. But like, that doesn't mean we can't joke around. That doesn't mean we can't like have genuine moments of like, highs and lows and be real human beings. And I think if anything, what I want Loose Grip to be is an engine for intentionality, but also like a place where people can fuck around and be like, hey, no, we just decided you got to do a podcast now. I have to be like, okay, I guess, I think there's a lot of freedom in that. And I've been lucky to see the benefits of it. And my hope is that our team kind of can, whether that's like, hey, I get to go work at my lake house in the summer, or I took a road trip. If we trust you to do good work, we'll trust you to do it from wherever you want. Like, it's cool. Go to town, man.
One thing that we talked about, especially in our conversations leading up to this, you mentioned that you believe profits and purpose aren't mutually exclusive. And so I'm wondering, how is this something that you disseminate to the brands and the clients that you work with when you're trying to get them to care about work with a purpose, even though they might be concerned about their bottom line?
Yeah, well, I would say that our best work is for brands who already know they have a purpose, and we're helping them figure out how best to use that for good, right? And for good, maybe selling more stuff or planting more trees or signing more voters up to register. There's a ton of ways that this stuff plays itself out. But I would say right now, especially given our political environment, brands are really tightening their belt, right? There's this natural kind of ebb and flow that happens in this big push for ESG, and everybody's doing green stuff, and you have ExxonMobil putting out their campaigns about how they're saving the planet. In some cases, a lot of like rightful pushback, I would say, on that stuff, where it's like, okay, but are you, right? Like, is that just pure greenwashing? But that has, from my perspective, gone too far the other way. Meaning the brands who are doing good should be talking about it. And if they're committed to it, they should be talking about it. And if they believe in it as a core element of their business, then it is worth communicating out. Because I think as consumers, we're all looking for brands who are like bold, right? Like, my take is a lot of products, because of globalization, because of AI, because of, the dissemination of information is really accessible to everybody in the world in very similar ways. Differentiation can't just be based solely on the product anymore, right? Like, yes, Patagonia makes great stuff. They make a killer fleece. I got some of them. They're awesome. I could probably find three other brands that are like pretty similar, right? Like literally that are like almost the identical product, maybe made by the same friggin' factory in Shenzhen. But I can't find those other brands who are as committed to the planet and to the causes and to the advocacy that those guys do. So my take is basically like, when we're talking to companies right now, if you're committed to doing good and being bold, you should be talking about it. And what we can really help companies do is see that impact, because it's really hard for people to judge, right? We had a guy on the podcast a few months ago who's a friend of mine, Chris Miller. He runs kind of the activism side at Aspen, which is a big resort, ski resort. But he previously, we worked with him at Ben & Jerry's, and he tells this story about how they did this very localized push to encourage voting. I think it was around the Senate elections, like when Warnock and the other guy got elected in Georgia. Ben & Jerry's was putting like tens of thousands of dollars in market to increase voter registration, localized to Georgia. And they happened to find that those posts were more effective at selling ice cream than a picture of ice cream, right? And so it's like, yeah, there's a whole lot of things that got to go into that. The ice cream has to be good. The values has to be genuine. It can't be virtue signaling. There has to be like legitimate track record over time. But if you can commit to it, we're really confident we can help people see that through line. And when the through line is visible, it's so much easier to ask for support and messaging, or support and money and resources and the willingness to say to the legal team, are we going to wade into this? That's hard to argue with unless you can go, okay, do you want to make less money in Georgia this month? Because we can do both, say the bold thing and sell more ice cream. And data is going to tell us whether that's working or not. And so if the data can help you make decisions and to advocate for the work that you're doing, then that's where the like real compound impact comes from.
One of the things you mentioned earlier was about the ability to work with really smart people who are doing good work. What is it like interfacing with companies that are forward and progressive thinking in this way? What feeling does that evoke in you? And how does that make your job easier?
Well, I would say generally it's tangible. So like at Loose Grip, we do this automated meeting recap where after every meeting on Slack, it shoots out a thing that says, hey, like, how did this meeting go? And there's, you know, a series of things just for like internal, like, hey, how do we think this did? And our goal is to be people's best meeting of the week, the month, the year. Like that's literally our goal. Our stated goal is to be the most fun meeting they have. And I'd say on the activism side, we hit that so often. Like there's just like a vibe that's really good. And I think there's two things. I think the first step is people who work for companies who are doing good, they really care about that doing good and that impact in the activism or the advocacy, because they could probably make more money somewhere else, right? If you wanted to work for Big Pharma, you could be a digital marketing manager and make 300 grand a year and whatever. If you want to help some small outdoor brand figure out how to, you know, plant some trees or get people to advocate for public lands, it's not going to be the place you make the most money, right? So they inherently are making decisions that are not solely based on how they can make the most money. And then secondarily, like because of that, I think they care about the output, because the output is not just money, meaning for their company as well. So if your company is, I need you to make 100 widgets or 1,000 widgets or sell 1,000 widgets, and then the company will then have $1 billion widget dollars, right? Like, okay, well, I can get up every day for that, but I'm mostly going to be thinking about this is a job that I get paid and you hand me my amount of money based on the amount of widgets I built or I sold or I marketed or whatever. If my job is, hey, we sell widgets and also we're like trying to save the world or the oceans or the people or help, you know, minimize the impacts of systemic racism or increase access to education or water or whatever, right? Like, it's just the type of people who do that work are more excited to do it. And they're more fun to work with because they're like really smart. There's a little bit less ego, because the thing people care about is, are we succeeding at the stated goal? I give this example a lot, which is basically like, there's an old saying in corporate America, the hippo's opinion is the one that is always most important. And the hippo is the highest paid person's opinion. Meaning whoever makes the most money in the room, if they want it to be blue, it's probably going to end up blue just because that's the person who makes the most money, right? Mm-hmm. Typically the CEO or whatever, the CMO, whatever it might be. In these companies on the value side, I don't see that nearly as much, right? I see like people saying, what does the data say? Does this work better than that? All right, let's do the thing that works better. And it sounds so obvious that companies would not just do the most effective thing, but we are all people who work in an environment that is surrounded by other people. And there's a lot of like team infighting and agencies and corporate politics and all the things that go into like why sometimes things that are not the most effective go out into the world. And I would say these companies that we talk to on the podcast and that we work with on this side of the business, they are lucky because they mostly get to do the work that's working the best and then do more of it. And when something doesn't work, they have a small enough ego to go, hey, what didn't work? So let's figure out, let's dive deep into what's not working and try to do a little bit less of that. So one of the things I try to ask these guys in the brands that we've been talking about is like, what have they changed their mind about? What has data helped them change their mind about? What things did they think were going to be really effective and maybe were less effective? Because you can tell that they probably have an answer and you learn a lot from those answers, you know?
Yeah. How do you manage, do you find yourselves pushing on companies that could be doing good, but aren't? Do you have any converts, I would say? And you don't have to give examples, but is that something that Loose Grip is in the business of doing?
Yeah, for sure. So a lot of times will happen is a company will come to us and maybe it's actually the activism people on the company who are coming to us, right? And they're sort of saying like, hey, I lead activism for this brand. And they know what they want to say. Mm-hmm. And they want to say it loud. And they want to say it a lot. And their marketing team maybe is less comfortable, right? Because they are the ones who get judged on, okay, great. It's cool that we got some people to sign up to plant the trees or post about Pride Month or do whatever. But we also need to sell stuff. And our job is based on how much stuff we sell. And one of the things we're really good at is taking people through a process that tries to build alignment, both from the marketing side and the activism or the values or the progressive side of the business, right? And honestly, one of my takes is that those two groups are way too siloed in all of these businesses, meaning like you might have a team that's dedicated to sustainability or to charitable endeavors or the blank company, Progressive Ventures or whatever, right? That's like an offshoot of the other company. I think they should be as close together as possible, because then you can start to see one can learn from the other. So the learnings and the insights, when they are most effective, one is informing the other in both directions. My best case scenario is this like head of sustainability and the CMO are like kind of get aligned on like, oh, actually that one metric is the best indicator of success for us. And maybe that metric, if we're really successful, it works for both. So the example that we give is we often have when we need these frameworks, one of the categories is convert, right? Like meaning like there's a specific action we want someone to take. But what's really cool about that is if we identify how we're going to gauge that success, then I can look at it on the e-commerce side. I can look at it on the email side. I can look at it on, did we sell more things through their app or whatever? Say, okay, yep, this kind of content leads to more of this convert metric. But I can also use that same metric if I have things structured the right way to say, did we sign more people up to vote? Did we have more people contact their congressperson about refugees or about immigration reform or about, you know, ICE detention centers? If I have one specific metric that works for both, then what's cool is I can go, all right, so now what style of content works best for driving action? Is it long videos that talk about the plight of whoever? Or is it like picture with an ask, you know, and like that little tactical stuff is super possible and actionable, but it has to have like alignment from their team up front. And so like there's a lot of sustainability folks, values folks, activism folks who work on a team where they're doing really good and they haven't yet found a way to bring the marketing team into the way they're thinking about success and sort of say, hey, we want to learn from you and we want you to learn from us. And the brands who do that are where we really see like, well, they're crushing on both sides, right? And the growth is exponential when it's ping-ponging back and forth between the two teams.
So Neil, we've been talking a lot about measured impacts here on the Measured Impact podcast. And I'm wondering, reflecting back on this season, you mentioned that you give yourself a performance review every year. How would you rate the performance of the podcast over the first season? And you can use whatever metric you like.
Oh, man. I've been really excited to talk to the companies that we've talked to. And that's a little bit of a flywheel effect, right? Like you start to talk to folks who get a little credibility and get over that imposter syndrome a little bit. I would say that was one of my hesitations going in, was like, okay, but who wants to talk about this stuff and with us, and why with us? And what we've seen is like really cool companies want to talk about this, and they're actually pretty transparent about like what works and what doesn't. They're not, it's not greenwashing. They're not just saying like, well, we're saving the planet, so of course we want to talk about, like, I think we've done a good job balancing bringing people in and asking them questions that are not so easy that it's just like, tell us about why you are the best company on the planet and you're saving the world. Like, we're trying to not throw all softballs up there. And it's been really fun to sort of get to ask people like, okay, how do you know you guys aren't virtue signaling, right? Talk deep about Bud Light and trans influencers and like, you know, kind of go into like questions that are like a little bit hard. So I would say my hope is as we continue to do this, we continue to get cool brands who are willing to be transparent, and we continue to ask them questions, because that I think is what makes for good content and honestly good discussions. And it's like, I think my team very much thought that I would have a natural take for this because they've seen me do a lot of these kind of interviews on the other side of the table, but mostly just because like I have a reputation for maybe like asking people a slightly uncomfortable question in a big group meeting, or being the person who like doubles down and says like, okay, so how? You're celebrating Pride Month this month? How? Right? Like, what are you doing? And I think that has made it so that we want that to be the expectation coming in, is like, we're not just looking for you to tell us how amazing you are and how you're saving the world. We also want to know like what didn't work and what could you have done better, and what is your team uniquely good at, and what do you guys need more work on? The best brands know that they don't know the answer to that, because that answer changes as platforms change, as content changes, as politics change. And so I think it's cool to see these guys learn from each other. And my hope is we can kind of bring some of that ethos to the table.
Well, you already answered my next question, which is what could we look for in season two? But I'll edit and say, is there a dream company or a dream interview you want to do in season two?
Well, literally every company, we ask them what companies they look up to. So one of the questions we ask is, what company do you look up to? And every answer is Patagonia. And I have to say, you can't say Patagonia. It's the same question every time. So obviously we would love the Patagonia folks to talk about their stuff. Yvon Chouinard and team have kind of been the inspiration for so many brands in this space. Mm-hmm. I think what I respect most about Patagonia is their willingness to criticize themselves and be self-critical, and to see the impact of how you build a billion-dollar business by sometimes putting out an ad that says, do not buy this fleece, or we're sorry, we didn't meet our commitments to workers' rights in Southeast Asia. Saying that stuff loud and being bold about it has worked so well for them, and they're kind of become the token. Who does everybody want to be? Well, they want to be people who are willing to be that courageous and to see it work really well over time. So I say Patagonia is high on that list. And then anybody who's got really good sandwich recommendations, we're big sandwich folks around here. So anybody who's got good recs.
Neil Callanan, thanks so much for being on the Measured Impact podcast.
Appreciate you, Ron. Thanks for asking me all the questions, man. Oh, before we wrap, I have to ask the most important question.
Sure.
Which is, Ronald Young Jr., if I was to come to the DC area, where would you send me to get the best sandwich?
Okay, I'm going to cheat and you're going to be mad, but I'm okay with that. In terms of sandwich being meat between two pieces of bread.
Oh my God, I thought you were about to say I wrap. It's not a wrap, is it?
Well, my first answer was a wrap, but this answer is going to be, this answer is going to make you more angry. So what DC is known for is called the half smoke from Ben's Chili Bowl. So you go to Ben's Chili Bowl, you get a half smoke, which is just a little sausage inside a bun, get it with a mustard, onions, chili, and cheese. Technically, that is a sandwich. That's where I would go. If you don't like that, there are plenty of Salvadorian restaurants around here. You get yourself a pupusa, which is technically a sandwich because all of the meat is enclosed inside of dough.
That's rich. I actually could probably get behind a hot dog being a sandwich, or a half smoke. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
For those that don't know, I spent my formative years in the DC area, so I spent plenty of late nights at Ben's Chili Bowl.
Okay, so you know what's up then.
I know very much what's up. And I'm a huge pupusa guy, but a pupusa is decidedly not a sandwich. There's no world in which a pupusa is a sandwich.
I have a sandwich for you. I actually have a sandwich for you. There's a place, it's in both Alexandria and DC, Capo Italian Deli. It actually started in DC, it's regional. They have solid sandwiches there. I always go and I get the turkey and roast beef sandwich. They do it on a Philly roll, or you can get it on a seeded roll. Very, very good. The one thing I will say is they don't have pepperoni there. I always like adding pepperoni to a sandwich, but you can add bacon, which is good. Get yourself some salt and vinegar, Miss Vicky's chips, and you got yourself a meal, man. You're in good shape.
I like.
I should have just said that first, but I just
No. Really, I like all those answers, and I think all three are valid in their own way.
See y'all later.
All right. Well, this has been awesome. Thanks, man.
Thank you both.